I'm John Kroll. Today on No Limits, we'll be talking with Indiana's preeminent historian, James Madison. Madison has written several books about the Hoosier State's history, including, most recently, a history titled, appropriately, Hoosiers. We'll talk with Madison about the characters and forces that helped shape Indiana as the state approaches its 200th birthday. Please join the conversation. Give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. Email us at nolimits@wfyi.org. Find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi or locate us on Twitter at WFYI. Now, this news.
No Limits is made possible by Apparatus, managing IT infrastructure so companies don't have to. It's advanced IT made simple. Learn more at apparatus.net.
Welcome to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of thestatehousefile.com, and your host. Well, today's show is a feast for lovers of Indiana history. My guest is James Madison, Indiana's preeminent historian. He's the author most recently of the book Hoosiers, which is a history of the state. If you'd like to join the conversation, please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. You also can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. Find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi or on Twitter at WFYI. Well, Jim, welcome back to the program. It's good to have you here.
Good to be here.
So tell me a little bit. You had written a history of Indiana before this that came out, what, about 30 years ago?
1986.
So just shy of 30 years ago. Why did you decide to revisit it?
Well, that book, titled The Indiana Way, is increasingly out of date. I wrote the first half of that book on a typewriter. Some of your listeners will know what a typewriter is. The second half on a very crude PC computer. That's how long ago it was. And I wanted to write about recent Indiana, and I have in this new book. The last several chapters deal with the last 30, 40 years, all the way up to the present. But also, we have changed as Hoosiers. Scholarship have changed. There's all sorts of things scholars, historians now know about Indiana and about the people of Indiana that we didn't know in the early 1980s when I was writing that first book.
How did you, you know, what areas, and I should say, I'll get this out of the way. I read your book. I really, really enjoyed it. In addition to being, you know, packed with details about the state that I did not know, it's also very gracefully written.
Thank you.
I would recommend to anyone who is listening to this, buy the book, read the book. You'll be glad you did. But what parts of the state's history? We can talk about the 30 or 40 years, you know, since you last wrote about it in a bit. But I'm always fascinated when a writer goes back to revisit earlier material. Often, you know, it's not just that the scholarship has changed, but let's face it, we don't necessarily think the same as individuals
we
did 30 years ago.
I don't as an individual.
I don't either.
And I've tried to write this from a 21st century perspective, but the scholarship has changed in just about any significant subject area of our history. Native American history is not what it was 30 years ago. African American history, and that's a big one, because when I wrote in the early 1980s, we knew very little about black Hoosiers. We now know a lot about Indiana pioneers, not all of whom were white. Mm-hmm. We know a lot about African Americans in the Civil War, all the way up to the Civil Rights Movement. So there's a lot more African American history folded into the general history of Indiana.
Was there any era in the state where you thought your earlier interpretation was either a little off kilter or required some tweaking or anything?
I mean, I was off kilter in just about every area. I think self-criticism is a pretty good virtue, and I was wrong in a lot of places. Take the Civil War, for example. Because of new scholarship, we now know that Governor Oliver P. Morton, who I think was the greatest governor in Indiana's history, was actually right when he said there were copperheads in Indiana attempting to take Indiana out of the Union and to allow the Confederacy to go its own way. We now know, and we didn't know this 30 years ago, that Morton was right. We now know a lot more about the Ku Klux Klan. That's a subject for three or four programs, John, but we know much more about who joined the Klan and what they were up to and why the Ku Klux Klan in the 1920s is far more important than we thought or knew three or four decades ago.
Yeah, and I do want to talk about the KKK, okay. Particularly in the context. The stories of Morton kind of fascinate me because you're right. I mean, you know, probably the only other governor, if we take the recent ones out of consideration and all the partisan arguments about whether living governors might be belong in that pantheon, probably the only rival that Morton's got is Paul McNutt.
I would agree with that. I think whatever your politics, McNutt was, in my judgment, the second most important governor because he lived and governed in such critical times, the Great Depression of the 1930s, but also because he was a different model of governor for the state of Indiana. So a very, very important figure in Indiana history, Paul V. McNutt from Martinsville, Indiana.
But in terms of Morton, I think people think because Indiana was a northern state that somehow there was some quality of consensus here, when in fact Indiana was like the nation in microcosm at that, you know, that there were these severe splits and that Morton pretty much had to send the legislature home and govern by himself.
He did. This was, in the history of Indiana, the bitterest, most contentious time in our past. What's going on today, we think we have a lot of disagreement and debate and incivility, but it's a Sunday school picnic compared to the Civil War era, where Hoosiers were deeply divided. There were communities that could not even get together on 4th of July. They had two 4th of July picnics and parades, one for those who supported the Union, one for those who wanted to leave the Union. It divided families, it divided churches, it divided communities. That is the position on the Civil War, what Indiana should do, what this war should be about. And once it came to be a war about emancipation, about freeing the slaves, then many white Hoosiers said, "This is not my war. I do not want to be a part of this war."
If you are just joining us, we are talking with Indiana historian James Madison, the author of a relatively recent book, Hoosiers, came out at the end of last year, right?
Correct.
If you'd like to join the conversation, please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. You can send an email to nolimits@wfyi.org. Find us on Facebook at No Limits WFYI or on Twitter at WFYI. How long after the Civil War did it take Indiana to sort of recover from those divisions? I mean, I'm thinking even in today's context, I mean, there are still hard feelings about the right to work battle, hard feelings about our fights over same-sex marriage and the Religious Freedom Restoration Act. And as you pointed out, those pale in comparison with what went on during the Civil War.
It took generations to recover from the bitter and deep wounds of the Civil War in Indiana among Hoosiers. Recovering, reuniting as a people required, and this was a complicit bargain with the devil in my view, that Hoosiers and Americans generally forgot about slavery, about race. They simply wrote that out of the story. And so the Civil War became a war not to free the slaves, which is what it was in fact, mm-hmm. but rather a war to save the Union. And in that process of remembering and commemoration over the years, the issue of slavery was written out of the story. That's why on the Circle in Indianapolis, that beautiful, beautiful soldier and sailor's monument is so unique and so important, because it has, carved in limestone, a slave freed with the manacles, the iron manacles broken, reaching up. Now, it's very controversial. It's been very controversial in recent years. But it's important admission on the Circle in Indianapolis that slavery and emancipation were key central parts of this war.
Yeah, it's been argued that that those questions of slavery and race are sort of America's original sin, the thing that we're still not getting past. And I'd planned on talking about this a little later, but I think probably this is is the appropriate moment. Obviously, there's a huge discussion about history, about race, about the Civil War, about its meaning going on in South Carolina right now, and the symbol of the Confederate flag. Well, it's not really the Confederate. It's the Confederate battle flag,
yes.
That flies atop the State House there. What do you think of all of that? What do you make of all of that?
Well, I'm the descendants of Madisons who fought for the Confederacy, and I feel entitled to say as a descendant and as a historian that they committed treason in 1861. It's really quite simple. They fired on the American flag. They fired against the uniform of the United States of America. They committed treason. Now, that makes things a little excessive and harder to heal. But that Confederate battle flag is an open wound, and it has been since it was rediscovered in the civil rights movement of the 1950s and 60s and then flown from state houses and all sorts of other ways. I find it obnoxious. For a long time, when I saw one on a truck or elsewhere, I would point my middle finger at it. Mm-hmm. My wife convinced me finally that probably was not a good thing to do. So I've stopped doing that. It's not polite either, but it is an outrage to my mind that that symbol of racism and nastiness and everything wrong about America has such a prominent place in parts of the United States.
What about the argument? We were talking before we went on the air about this issue that, you know, the argument people generally advance, unless they are like this, obviously deeply disturbed young man who committed this atrocity in Charleston, that it is a part of, the South's heritage and therefore should be acknowledged and incorporated into the state's history. You and I were talking and saying there's a significant difference between acknowledgement and celebration.
Exactly. It is a part of the South's history, a part of American history, and it needs to be known. It needs to be presented and understood in the context of what it was during the Civil War and what it is today. But that's not celebrating. The opposite, to sweep it under the carpet, as we did with Indiana's Klan of the 1920s, to pretend it doesn't exist, is equally wrong. So the Confederate flag needs to be in museums. It needs to be in programs. It needs to be in classrooms as teaching source, as documents about the Civil War and about our struggles with race down to the 21st century.
In Indiana, as you say, it took generations for the divisions to heal, and just sort of the product of the way that they got past those divisions sounds like an almost deliberate amnesia.
Oh, I think it was deliberate. I think many people knew exactly what they were doing when they agreed that in order for the Union and the state to come together and forget the trials and tribulations of the Civil War, we must simply stop talking about race and equality for all. And that was a bargain with the devil, as I say.
So we have this period then, the latter half of the 19th century, when, the state is attempting to come to terms with that legacy. It's also the period when Industrial Revolution and all of that, Indiana became, in some ways, now an incubator of progressivism. Eugene Debs and all of those folks are coming to power. What produced that?
Well, this period you're talking about, John, late 19th century, early 20th century, is sometimes called the Golden Age of Indiana. I'm a little antsy about that. It's too extreme. It's too strong. But it was certainly a time period when things were happening. Industrial and agriculturally, Indiana, part of the Midwestern heartland, was part of the most sophisticated, advanced industrial and agricultural production in the world, not just in America. There's no place else like it in the world in 1900 or 1910 for economic productivity on farm and factory. In addition, there's this outpouring of reform, of art, of painting, of music, of interest in public health, So all sorts of things were going on at the very first years of the 20th century. It's a very exciting time in Indiana history.
If you are just joining us, we are talking with Indiana's preeminent historian, James Madison. He is the author, most recently, of A New History of Indiana, the second history of Indiana he has written. It's called Hoosiers. If you'd like to join the conversation, please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. That's a toll-free call. You also can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. Find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi or on Twitter at WFYI. I am John Kroll. I'm talking with James Madison. You are listening to No Limits. Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StatehouseFile.com, and your host. We are talking with Indiana's preeminent historian, James Madison, who's the author of several books of Indiana history, including most recently Hoosiers, a new history of his second history of the state. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can do so by sending us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. You can find us on Facebook at No Limits WFYI, on Twitter at WFYI, or you can do what Bruce did and give us a call at 866-476-3881. Bruce, welcome to the program.
Hey there. When I first saw War for the Union on the War Memorial, that was the first time I encountered the phrase. So I'm wondering if this was a phrase generally used in Indiana and perhaps elsewhere, current at the time, or whether this was something that perhaps historians put on when the monument was raised.
No. First of all, the monument was built by the veterans of the Civil War. The Hoosier veterans of the Civil War drove the process of memorializing this war all across the state and all across America. So every courthouse square in Indiana virtually has a Civil War marker or memorial on it. The one in the circle in Indianapolis with the words War for the Union, I think, is traditional. That's the way many people thought of it at the time and continued, especially after the war, to think of it rather than the war to emancipate slaves.
Uh-huh. Were the Copperheads called traitors around the time of the Civil War?
Governor
we'll
Morton.
Get you an answer, Bruce. Thanks very much for the call and the question.
Okay.
Go ahead, James.
Yes. The question was, were the Copperheads called traitors? And the answer is yes, they were, certainly by Oliver P. Morton and other Republicans who claimed at the time that there were many Hoosiers, all of them virtually Democrats, the opposition party, who were disloyal, who were not supporting the Union, and some of them aggressively seeking to take Indiana out of the war, who were committing acts of treason, who were gathering weapons and preparing to march on Indianapolis to free Confederate prisoners held here in town, to open up the state arsenal and distribute those weapons. For a long time, we were rather discounting that extreme view of Copperheads, claiming that this was just Oliver Morton using it against Democrats for political effect. He wouldn't be the first or last politician to do that. But we now know that there actually were Copperheads. There actually were conspiracies. There actually were armed movements in Indiana by Hoosiers for Hoosiers in the direction of taking Indiana out of the Union.
How do we know this?
We know this because historians, Steve Towne down at IUPUI and many others, have worked very hard in the archives, in the libraries, at the primary sources, at the actual documents, and have sorted through hundreds and thousands of papers, pieces of paper, to get to this meaning, this understanding.
Well, and it stands to reason because one state over in Ohio, I mean, there was a gubernatorial candidate, right? And wasn't he a former member of Congress who was imprisoned and then
well,
deported.
This is Vallandigham, I think you're talking
about.
I was avoiding
pronouncing the name because even though I've Clement, right, was the
Clement
first.
Clement Vallandigham, yes.
Yeah, I never could figure out how to pronounce the last name, so thank you for saving me on that one. But that was the Midwest itself often was very divided about war.
And, of course, this is in part, there are many reasons for someone choosing not to support the Civil War. but many of them have to do with family and other ties to the South. Remember that a great majority of the people who settled Indiana in the very early pioneer period came from the upland South, from Virginia and Kentucky and Tennessee, and they still have relatives in the South. So they're not in favor of slavery, but they're also not in favor of making Virginia or North Carolina do what Virginians don't want to do.
We are talking about Indiana history with Indiana's preeminent historian, James Madison. If you'd like to join the conversation, give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. Pat, welcome to the program.
Oh, thank you for having me on. I have a question about the high school mascot at New Palestine, Indiana. My granddaughter is there currently, and her father went to school there, and I think even her grandmother, another grandmother. So they've been told that the dragon, they're told by some people that don't really know what they're talking about, but that the dragon mascot is somehow connected with the Ku Klux Klan. Can you shed any light on that? And thank you for your book. I'm going to buy it and read it and give it to my family. But what can you say about that?
Great. Thanks very much for the call and the question, Pat.
Thank you, Pat. And this gives me an opportunity to demonstrate early in the program my ignorance. I do not know. It's a fascinating connection. But I suspect that not connected to the Klan. One of the favorite conversations I had with a student at Indiana University many years ago who came up to me after class and said, is it true that all towns in Indiana that have a color in the name, like Whitestown, are actually sundown towns where African Americans are not permitted to live? And I had never heard of that before, and I've never heard of it since. But people come up with amazing ideas. Some of them are true.
What is the most unusual? I am going to veer us into a serious conversation about the Klan and its history and legacy here in Indiana. But what you give me a setup like that about some of these stories are true. What in your research was the when you had one of those moments that I refer to as someone who writes nonfiction an awful lot too, where you say, oh, why do people bother to write fiction? And, you know, when there's stuff like this out there that's that sort of borderline unbelievable but actually happened.
Well, I think that almost every day, John. To me, history, and I'm a history geek, as you know, but history is so fascinating. You couldn't make this stuff up. In its tragedies sometimes, in its silliness sometimes, in its absurdities, in its significance. And so virtually every story, every subject has that kind of you-can't-make-it-up version to it.
We've gotten an email from a listener named Kathy, and if you'd like to reach out to us by email, you can do so at nolimits@wfyi.org. Kathy says, before the Civil War, there were Native Americans here, of course. I would like to hear your guest perspective on what the general relationships were between settlers and natives, and how frequently were there marriages between them, as William Connor and Menkings, I hope I'm pronouncing
it. Mekingus, I think.
Mekingus. And why did she have to leave? Any new information about that part of our history?
That's a wonderful question and a big one. Let me just pick a few pieces of it. Native Americans and Euro-Americans intermarried frequently, particularly in the French period. The French who were here, and remember, the language of Indiana was once French. The French who were here were usually all male, and they married frequently. And so did some of the early...
And sometimes concurrently.
And, yes, yes, indeed. And so did the early Anglo-American settlers and American settlers, and William Connor's a wonderful example of that, because there were so few American white women around, and for other reasons, for reasons of trade and getting ahead in life, he took a Native American woman as his wife, and they had children. Why did she have to leave? Well, this is the story of removal, and it's a tragic and complex story. But most white Hoosiers came to the conclusion by the 1820s that Native Americans simply had to go, that we could not live with them, they could not live with us. And they made an argument, maybe sort of true, that actually Native Americans would be better off if they were removed from the state, because of the very debilitating conditions that they were living in. And so removal was forced. They were required. They were driven by armed guards from their homelands, from their state, out of the state, and far to the west. William Connor decided that his best interests were in having his Native American wife and children leave, and within a few months after, he married an American woman and had other children and continued to be a model of capitalism, of growth, of economy. And his story is so well told today at Connor Prairie. If you don't know that story and all its dimensions, I'm just giving you a couple of pieces of it here. Connor Prairie is really the place to go.
And we should talk. I mean, right now we've talked about the Civil War and obviously the fact that the state was much more divided. We've now talked about the removal. I mean, these are not necessarily particularly proud periods in the state's history. We probably ought to, drop the last piece of that and talk about the rise of the Klan.
Right.
Can you talk a little bit? You say we now know far more about that era. What do we know about it that we didn't know before?
Well, it's important to begin by forgetting what you know about other clans in other places and other times. The Indiana Klan of the 1920s is very different from the Klan that came into existence in the 1950s and 60s and 70s here in Indiana, especially in Mississippi. We now know who joined the Klan in Indiana in 1923 and 1924. We know, because scholars have studied membership lists and linked them with other data, we know that good Hoosiers joined the Klan. Lawyers, businessmen, doctors, Rotary Club members, librarians, teachers joined the Indiana Klan in the 1920s. Middle class, educated, not ignorant, not the unwashed, not the racists who can quickly be dismissed, but good people, good Hoosiers joined the Klan. And they believed in joining the Klan that they were fighting against what they saw as the decline of America, that Indiana and America was going down the tubes for all sorts of reasons, for all sorts of changes that were in the air. People not obeying the law, not obeying the law of prohibition, going out to these roadhouses and drinking and listening to this wild music and dancing. And they said some of these young women, these flappers, they didn't even wear underwear. This was all a sign of the decline of America. And then who's causing this? Well, there are evil people in the world, and there are wicked people in the world. And, of course, some of them are Jewish and some of them are African-American. But for the Klan in Indiana of the 20s, it wasn't African-Americans, it wasn't Jews so much as it was Catholics. And that's hard for younger folks to understand. But anti-Catholicism in the Protestant churches in Indiana and in America was deep, a long, long roots of anti-Catholicism as a foreign church, a papacy, a ethnic church full of Germans and Irish and others. And all of these forces, all of these people and groups outside, white Protestant Hoosiers, were becoming the enemy. And the Klan was going to stand up to them and follow their God and their flag to redeem America.
I've gotten an email question from a listener named Bruce. And if you'd like to reach out to us by email, you can do so at nolimits@wfyi.org. Bruce has got a two-part question. What was the extent of the connections between the Copperheads and the Klan? And then the second one is, how did the Klan appeal to high-class, well-educated, commercially and socially prominent Hoosiers?
I think the first question, I can't think of any deep connection, either directly or in ideology so much, between the Copperheads and the Klan. I think they're both challenging to some degree the mainstream government leadership, but that's not so true with the Klan because, in fact, we now know that the Indiana governor time, Ed Jackson, my candidate for the worst governor ever in Indiana's history, was, if not a member of the Klan, a very, very strong advocate of the Klan. He stood next to D.C. Stevenson at his gubernatorial inauguration. As to better-off people, leaders, affluent people joining the Klan, yes, they did. Some of them did so because it was good business to belong to the Klan. You would be ostracized in some communities if you weren't a member of this patriotic, God-fearing organization. It was a place to meet people and to do business. So some joined for that reason, but many also joined because they honestly believed that the Klan was a reform organization, that it was going to clean up Indiana and lift up Indiana.
Gotten this question you're going to love. It's a Facebook question from a listener named Nick. If you'd like to reach out to us on Facebook, you can do so at No Limits WFYI. Nick says, where can we purchase this new book by Dr. Mattison?
That must be my brother, Nick. Okay. No, I don't have another brother named Rick. So, well, I think it's readily available in most book outlets and stores online at these companies. I think one's called Amazon or something like that. But one of my favorite places to purchase would be at the Indiana Historical Society gift shop on 450 West Ohio Street. They have copies in there. But lots of other bookstores around the state especially will have it on their shelves.
We've also gotten a comment from a listener named Steve via Twitter. If you want to send us a tweet, you can do so at WFYI. Steve says, regarding changes in Indiana, Indy has become a big city for better food, more culture, better sports, and for worse, more crime, crowds, and traffic. I mean, in some ways, is that the story of the state as well?
No, I don't think. I think, actually, it gets us off track a little bit. But I have this argument nowadays that Indiana is actually moving in two directions, toward two Indianas. One doing very well, thank you, central Indiana, certain parts of Indianapolis, Hamilton County in particular, and some pockets out there, Bloomington, my town, Wabash, others. But that much of the community outside of those areas is really struggling, and we're moving toward two Indianas further and further apart. As to the growth of this city, well, it's just phenomenal. I know what this city was like in the 1960s. It's hard to believe how it has changed. It's one of the great success stories in American history, in Indiana history, certainly. There was a time when people said that Indianapolis was just another small town, a little bit bigger, but the same as any of the small towns, the county courthouse towns across the state. That's no longer the case. And Indianapolis now plays a much larger role, a much more important role in our state than it had 50 or 100 years ago.
I'm going to ask a question before we leave sort of the Klan. Did you see the same sort of, you know, deliberate cultural amnesia about the Klan's rise to power in the 1920s? I mean, it was not something that people boasted about.
It was not. After the unhappy demise of the Klan, many Hoosiers, most Hoosiers, were deeply embarrassed by the Ku Klux Klan. But rather than talk about it, rather than address the fundamental issues that are so important and are still important in the 21st century, Hoosiers, most of them, simply swept it under the rug and said, we're not going to talk about it. Even historians, until recently, did not write very much about the Klan. So we were ignorant of our own history in a way that I think does not serve our present or our future.
I would think that would be somewhat. Well, although if you can sort of sweep the entire Civil War and that tumult under, this great cataclysm in the middle of the 19th century, I suppose it's possible. But, I mean, this was national attention. I mean, the Indianapolis Times won a Pulitzer Prize for its coverage of the Klan. How did we go about that? Has it just become one of those things you did not mention in polite society?
I think Hoosiers are very modest and very nice people. And one of the consequences of that is we don't like conflict very much. We want to be nice to people. We want to smile. And if things get a little too tense and too full of conflict, we stop talking about it sometimes.
So, and we had the whole story of D.C. Stevenson and all of that, a guy who, I guess, pretty much disappeared.
Well, he went to jail.
Went to jail, but then, from what I gather, somebody did, finally track down where he died, I think.
Yeah, he ended up in Seymour much later, but he did disappear from the spotlight, and that was because there was really a strong incentive, particularly in the Republican Party, which was the party closely associated with the Klan, to make him disappear and to make all memory of the Klan disappear, and particularly the party's connections to the Ku Klux Klan in the 1920s.
We are talking about Indiana history with Indiana's preeminent historian, James Mattison. If you'd like to join the conversation, give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. You can send an email to nolimits@wfyi.org. Find us on Facebook at No Limits WFYI or on Twitter at WFYI. I'm John Kroll. Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StatehouseFile.com, and your host. We are talking about Indiana history with the state's preeminent historian, James Madison. He is the author, most recently, of a history of Indiana called Hoosiers. And I should say that's not your only. As the state approaches its bicentennial, that is not the only historical endeavor you're involved in. You're actually doing some work for us as well, right?
Well, I am for the television program at WFYI. We're doing a 3-hour documentary on Indiana's history, sort of taking the book and putting it on screen, but with a lot of people involved in that. So we've started the shoot. We were in Corydon. On Monday, I'll be in Delphi, Indiana, which has a wonderful canal park. And God willing, I'll be standing on a canal boat talking about the building of canals in the 1830s in Delphi.
Yeah, just don't shift around too much in the boat. That would make for some interesting video, I think, if you have that. And this is scheduled to air then next spring, right?
Late next spring. We're on a tight deadline, but we're working very hard, and I'm very excited about the project. We're going to tell some of the usual stories. We've talked about them on the program today, Oliver Morton. But we're also trying to tell some stories in this 3-hour program that are different, that will bring aspects of Indiana's history to light that few people know about.
Got an email from a listener named Molly talking about familiar stories. If you want to reach us by email, you can do so at nolimits@wfyi.org. Molly says, you might be tired of this old question, but do you have any thoughts on the origins of the name Hoosiers for the people of Indiana? What is the best or most interesting theory you have heard? Thanks from a proud Hoosier.
Yes. Thank you, Molly. Maybe I get tired of that question, but then I quickly remind myself of what we have in Indiana. We have, in the word Hoosier, I think the greatest brand that any state in the Union has. And I think we ought to embrace it. We ought to be proud of it. We've had it for almost 150 years. We have letters at the Indiana Historical Society Library written in the 1830s where correspondents used the word Hoosier. We don't know what it means. I like that, too, because then it has a certain mystery, a certain kind of ethereal quality to it, and it makes us special, we Hoosiers. So I like the brand. I like the word. I start in this new book called Hoosiers, of all things. In the first pages, I lay out some of the many stories that have been told, and there's some howlers out there, and no one to this day knows, I don't think anyone is likely to know where the word comes from.
It is interesting. I lived in St. Louis for a couple of years.
Yes,
went to
that's
grad
a different
school,
word.
Grad school there. And, you know, they called me a Hoosier, and it wasn't a compliment.
It wasn't a compliment.
It was
in St.
not
Louis.
A compliment at all. We are talking about Indiana history with James Madison, the state's preeminent historian. If you'd like to join the conversation, please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. Bob, welcome to the program.
Thank you. Thank you for taking my call.
Certainly.
And I really appreciate the comments about the early Klan in the 20s, because my relatives, my grandfather, in fact, and my father were merchants in Noblesville. And I know my grandfather was a member of the Klan. However, hired African-Americans and, you know, was a respected businessman. And I thought, well, it's a bit of a conflict in my mind until I hear your comments about that. So, you know, anything more, it seems like half or three quarters of the businessmen in Noblesville, from what I've heard at that time, were Klansmen.
Thanks very much for the call and the question, Bob.
That comment, Bob, is exactly on target. That is what we've learned from the new scholarship on the Klan. People like your grandfather and many other merchants and businessmen joined the Klan and were not necessarily strongly anti-racist. Now, everyone knew in Indiana, all whites knew, that African Americans were second-class citizens. That's the way it was. As horrible and tragic as it was, we paid a huge price for that, but it was not unusual. It would have been very unusual to find a white Hoosier in 1925 who genuinely believed in and worked for racial equality. There were some, but not many.
Well, and there was a lot of racial hostility. One of your other books obviously dealt with the fact that you know, Indiana has the definitely dubious distinction of being host to the last lynching north of the Mason-Dixon.
Yes, and that was in 1930 in Marion, Indiana. It could have happened other places, but a white mob lynched two African-American teenagers on the Grant County Courthouse Square. And I spent a lot of time writing a book that I'm still rather proud of about that horrible tragedy. It's called A Lynching in the Heartland, where I try to take apart those events and explain them in a way that makes sense, even though it still doesn't make sense, truly.
We've gotten an email from a listener named Frank. If you want to reach out to us by email, you can do so at nolimits@wfyi.org. Frank says, my friend, the amateur historian, told me that there was once a march of about 1,000 laborers to the State House and that the outraged governor called out the National Guard state militia against them. What of this?
I'm not sure what that would be. Perhaps the biggest use of militia against labor strikers and labor action was during Governor Paul McNutt's administration, where there was a big general strike in Terre Haute, and McNutt declared martial law, sent over the National Guard. It was pretty harsh. Some called him a Hoosier Hitler at the time.
Yeah, and that, I mean, it was. We actually had the man's name is escaping me. Who wrote the recent biography of Paul?
Yes, Dean Katowski.
Yes, Dean Katowski on the show just a few weeks ago, and you know what emerged from that is the personality. I mean, in his book, somehow I had not thought of McNutt as vivid a character as he was. You know, he came across as the kind of guy who could strut sitting down.
Yes.
You know, and there were jokes about how they needed to let the dome off of the Capitol to expand more, create more room for his ego and all of that sort of stuff. We have gotten an email from a listener named Richard. Says, can you address the efforts of the Underground Railroad? I've seen several markers in the Franklin area.
Yes, the Indiana Historical Bureau, which is in charge of the MARCO program, has done a great job of getting more and more markers commemorating and locating Underground Railroad sites. This is the effort of Hoosiers, white and black, but a lot of African Americans involved in this, we now know, to help slaves escaping across the Ohio River from Kentucky, which is slave territory, into Indiana, which is free territory before the Civil War. It's a very important part of Indiana's history, and the fact that we're marking it is, I think, wonderful.
We've also gotten an email from a listener named, I hope, Tamala. Or Tamala. How did the Indiana Ku Klux Klan go from hating Catholics to hating and lynching African Americans?
Well, the Indiana Klan, so far as I know, never lynched an African American. I've had a standing offer, $100 reward for anyone who can provide the documentary proof that they did. So far, I've kept my $100. They didn't lynch African-Americans. And the Klan, as I said in the 1920s, was less concerned about African-Americans and other issues. The Klan that then comes into existence in the 1960s, and there are parts of it here in Indiana, is primarily focused on African-Americans and is primarily a statement against the civil rights movement of Martin Luther King and others. That's a very, very different kind of Klan from the Indiana Klan of the 1920s. It has a very small following in Indiana. It's not of great significance, but you can't dismiss it either.
And I should say that my astute producer, Shannon Cagles, pointed out that the author of the McNutt book, Dean Katlowski.
Katlowski, thank you.
Yes. We pronounced that right. We are talking about Indiana history here on No Limits. If you'd like to join the conversation, please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. Raina, welcome to the program.
Hi there. Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Certainly. Did I pronounce your name right?
Yes, you did. Raina.
Good.
Yes. So I'm from Pennsylvania, and when I moved here about 13 years ago, I was pretty shocked by the deep and extensive history of the Klan here. I'm African-American, and it actually made me a little uncomfortable when I first moved here. And I hear Mr. Madison describe the Klan as mostly a social organization, but I wanted to make sure that it didn't pass by that this organization, although perhaps initially social, still did commit pretty horrible acts of violence for people of African and other descent.
That's true.
Thanks very much for the call.
You're absolutely right, Raina, for the Klan of the 1960s. There's no question about that, particularly in Mississippi and Alabama and places that I as a Hoosier regard as godforsaken places. But in Indiana, that Klan in the 60s was pretty small potatoes, but they did engage in some violence. Some of them were literally insane. The firebombing of an African-American shop on in Bloomington, Indiana in the late 1960s is an example of that. But in Indiana, there's no Klan going around at any time and lynching African-Americans. This is not to say that racial differences did not exist or do not exist. Segregation and discrimination lie deep in the heart of Indiana history from the very beginning into the 21st century. But that's a different kettle of fish from what I think you're talking about.
Well, and in terms of talking about the 1920s Klan, the Klan that got, you know, as far as I know, Indiana is still another dubious distinction, is the only state in which the Klan got control of the state government.
Well, the Klan certainly got a lot of control of the state government. And had they existed longer, that's another aspect of the Klan's history that gets lost. They didn't run Indiana for decades. They had power for 3 or 4 years. It was a very short period of time. And it was one gubernatorial administration. But had Stevenson not committed his horrendous crime, had he been able to keep that organization gone, it might have been something very different, too, in terms of controlling Indiana's government.
And we probably ought to lay out what that horrendous crime was here, that he raped and brutalized.
He raped and brutalized a young statehouse worker, Madge Oberholzer, this man who claimed to be doing the work of the God and the work of the American flag, committed a horrendous crime. Madge Oberholzer took poison and died a long and painful death, but spilled the beans before she died, enough to bring Stevenson to trial and to send him off to the Michigan City Penitentiary where he belonged.
We have a lot of calls here and other messages, so I'm going to ask that our callers try to keep their questions brief. Ryan, welcome to the program.
Hello?
Hello, Ryan. Welcome to the program.
Yes, Ryan. Hey, I was calling to see if on his book, it sounds very interesting, whether he comments on the Frontier era with George Rogers Clark and Simon Benton and those. I'll take my call off the air.
Thanks very much, and sorry to get your name wrong.
Yes, we didn't get to talk about that, but I write a fair bit about George Rogers Clark, one of the great heroes of Indiana, but a hero who recent scholarship has helped us understand. Here's a story about Clark that was not told in the old days, I don't think. After he took Fort Sackville on the banks of the Wabash from the British in 1779, a great victory in Indiana and American history, he ordered his men, who had 4 Indian captives bound, to take those captives to the bank of the Wabash River, where they simply drove tomahawks into the back of their heads. In other words, they murdered prisoners of war in cold blood, and their blood ran in the Wabash River. That's the way Clark fought. That was the warfare of the frontier. And it's something that maybe it's justified, maybe it's not. That's not the point. But it's something that it's an aspect of Clark's history, an aspect of a heroic history that needs to be incorporated to understand fully the stories.
I think we've got time to squeeze in one more caller. Bash, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much. Very interesting topic.
Thank you.
I was a pastor for 30 years at a small little Christian church that was built by the Ku Klux Klan. And today is the anniversary of that dedication on June 23rd, 1923. And I have been amazed to see and hear the number of Christian churches that were built and funded by the Klan itself. I just wondered if you had any information about that.
Thanks very much for the call, Bash.
Well, that's a very good point, and it helps make the larger point of the connection between the Ku Klux Klan in Indiana in the 1920s and Protestant churches. Methodists, Baptists, Presbyterians, mainline Protestant denominations, Disciples of Christ, Christians. One of the standard Klan actions was on Sunday morning at church service, a group of Klan members would gather in full regalia with a pile of money. They'd put it in a collection plate, march down the aisle of the church to the altar, put the plate on the altar, turn around and walk out. Not a word said, but a very powerful demonstration of the Klan and their attachment to Protestant churches.
How closely were they related? And I realize we haven't fulfilled my earlier pledge that we were going to talk to about the recent 30 or 40 years, but, you know, we've had too many interesting points, too much interesting conversation here, and we'll just have to have you back so that we can talk with about that. But how what kind of connection was there between the 1920s Klan and some of the earlier nativist movements? It sounds like that like the Know-Nothings.
Yes, there's a deep tradition in American history and Indiana history of nativism, that is, of not trusting those who are not like us. If you're not like me, there's something wrong with you. And that runs through American history from the Puritans down to the present, as a matter of fact. We can't get to the 21st century on that particular issue without even mentioning RFRA, for example. But there were nativist movements in Indiana history in the 1850s, for example, and at other times. And the Klan builds on that tradition in American history of being wary, uncertain, and even angry about those who are not like I am, whether that's I'm left-handed, I think all people ought to be left-handed, but there are other ways in which you're not like me and therefore are automatically distant and different.
As sort of the last point, what is the part of our history as Hoosiers that is most often overlooked? You know, the trend, overarching theme to our history that you know, is often forgotten.
Well, I think it's still in the 21st century, it's African-American history, which I think is so rich in Indiana, so wonderful. The stories of courage and of tragedy and of overcoming are just amazing stories. And we've started to tell them. Lots of people have started to tell them in museum exhibits, in books, in programs. There's a new documentary being made right now on Crispus Attucks, the high school here in town. Those stories are better known than they were 50 years ago, but there's still so many to learn and to teach and to spread.
And that probably will have to be the last word. I mean what I say, though. I would like for you to come back when we have an air date for the documentary that you're working on for WFYI so we can talk more about Indiana history. Next time, I'll be more disciplined. We will get to that 30 or 40 years, and I would like to apologize to our listeners whose questions we couldn't get to. Hear me now. We are going to have Jim back so that he can talk more about Indiana history. If you would like to listen to this program again, you can do so online or on the podcast at WFYI. Jim, thank you very much for spending this
time.
Thank
you,
John. I really enjoyed the conversation. I am John Kroll. You have been listening to No Limits. Thank you for joining us.
No Limits is a production of 90.1 WFYI Public Radio, Indianapolis. Executive producer, Michelle Johnson. Producer, Shannon Cagle. Interactive media coordinator, Melissa Davis. Technical producers, Cedric Freeman and Chris Flood. And board engineer, Joe Hatcher. Abby Terzini screens our calls. No Limits is made available through IPBS, Indiana's public broadcasting stations.